Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
This podcast is supported by FedEx. FedEx offers fast delivery, more visibility, simple returns, and weekend home delivery to 98% of the U.S. population on Saturday and 50% on Sunday. With FedEx, you get picture proof of delivery, ensuring you always know where your package is. Returns are simple with packageless and paperless returns. Plus, FedEx Ground is also faster to more locations than UPS Ground. See the FedEx service guide for delivery information. So, what are you waiting for? See what FedEx can do for your business. Absolutely, positively, FedEx.
Welcome to the Nerdist Podcast number 852. This episode is brought to you by the enhanced editions of George R.R. Martin's Game of Thrones books, available exclusively on iBooks, including the just-released A Feast for Crows enhanced edition, which has interactive character maps, hundreds of author notes, incredible illustrations, a sigil guide, and much, much more. All these extras bring the adventure to life and help you stay on top of all the storylines. Get A Feast for Crows Enhanced Edition exclusively on iBooks, or you can just go to apple.co/Game of Thrones. I'm sorry, not available in all countries. I apologize. It's not my... I don't control these things, don't you know? But thanks to Game of Thrones for sponsoring this episode of the podcast. Let's go to the Nerdist Community Corkboard. Ralph Puma, that is a great name. That's a fantastic name. That's like a... Should we get like an MMA battle of Chester Cheetah and Ralph Puma? Now, Ralph, I know you've probably heard that your entire life. Whenever you think you've stumbled across a thing that teases someone's last name, they've heard it a million times, 100% of the time. So I apologize. Also, I'm not going to go back and edit it out. Are you mad? Anyway, Ralph produced and developed a 6-episode half-hour comedy web series called Solace. It's about a comic book store. The first episode's available on YouTube. And since Anthony Hopkins' Solace has pushed them completely to the bottom of the list, you would have to find them by searching Solace Comics. That would be very helpful. Then, Tanner McCandlish, who sounds like the villain in the Ralph Puma Chester Cheetah story. I feel like Tanner McCandlish is the one who's... he's trying to get Ralph Puma to throw that cat fight, and Ralph's like, I guess I'll do it for my kids. But then when he gets in the ring, he realizes, like, I can't go down because for my kids. So then he fights back, and then Tanner McCandlish basically hunts him the entire movie. And then his former nemesis, Chester Cheetah, like, they team up at the end. Because Tanner's been pulling the strings on Chester for too long and making him be all cheesy, and he doesn't like that. He wants to just be a cheetah and eat, hunt gazelle and not have to talk about scrunchy, delicious cheese snacks. I feel like that kind of petered out at the end there, but you get it. You know, it's a work in progress. Anyway, Tanner says, I feel like the Community Corkboard is the perfect place to let people know about the Barbara Ireland Walk and Run for Breast Cancer. Every year, I participate in this charity event to raise money for breast cancer awareness in Santa Barbara. Great cause. 100% of the donations go straight to research and supporting care programs. This year, my team, Save Second Base, has a goal to reach at least $5,000 in donations. We'd love for you guys to help get the word out about this fundraiser. The event is Saturday, March 11th. Still plenty of time for the listeners of The Nerdist to help out. You can find the team page and donate at tiny.cc/save-second-base. Aw, Tanner, you were a good guy the whole time. Aw. So this episode is Mr. Alan Tudyk, a man I've known for many, 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 many years and have delighted in seeing his ascension to the top of the nerd chain. Alex, a great guy. We did a sitcom pilot in like the year 2001, I think. And on top of that, of course, I think you know how I feel about Firefly. I'm a fan of pretty much everything Alan does. So it was really fun to have him on. He was on At Midnight with Ron Funches and Danny Pudi because they're promoting Powerless, which is Thursdays at 8:30 p.m. on NBC. And Alan had never been on At Midnight before, and he destroyed. Oh, my God. The whole show was funny. Everyone was great, but Alan crushed. So very exciting. Very exciting to see him as K2SO in Rogue One, and which is really great. I got to watch that movie 100 times. And then Con Man, which is a series that he created and wrote. That's over on Comic-Con HQ. If you go to conmantheseries.com, you can watch that. A lot of people in there that you know and love. So, yeah, Alan Tudyk on the podcast. I don't think he's actually the first time he's been on the podcast, because there's not a Returns after his name in the listed in iTunes. That's now you can see the Matrix code behind what we're doing. Speaking of Matrix code, John Wick 2. Huh? That is what you call a happy accident segue, only ruined by the fact that I pointed it out. But John Wick 2, Keanu Reeves, just on the podcast, the last episode of the podcast. John Wick 2 is fucking fantastic. It's so much fun. It's exactly what you want it to be. Just, it starts from the second the lights go down, and then it's just a super shoot 'em up assassinating video game. Keanu Reeves is a beast in the best way possible in this movie. So yeah, go see John Wick 2. It's in theaters. Please watch it. Support people who have supported the Nerdist Podcast and support fun action movies. And now, here's the Nerdist Podcast number 852 with Mr. Alan Tudyk. Katie, please roll the thing.
Now entering Nerdist.com.
What?
This is a whole thing of popcorn.
Oh my god.
Look at that.
This is amazing.
Yeah, it's not as...
Oh my god. No, it is. It is.
I want it to be brimming with...
The wife is going to go crazy. Good. She loves... We have a little media room with lots of snacks.
Oh, good,
this is going to be perfect. Thank
good.
You so much.
Good.
This is lovely.
No K2...
On the whole.
Where's K2? Where's the K2 merch?
If you give me a Sharpie, I'll draw him in.
Or just write the
I did that at the store. Store.
Or just write K2 on it. Like, oh, he's there. He's there in spirit.
The popcorn's BBA. A year old. So that's
is there coffee I could get?
We can find a coffee.
Yeah. Where's yeah.
Deb, can you get us coffee?
Yep.
So cool fucking Team Stark patch on that jacket there.
Oh, thank you. What do you want your coffee?
Just milk and sugar.
Okay.
Regular.
Can I have a decaf one of those?
Milk and sugar too? Or
just milk. And please don't mix them up or I'll die. All right.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I can't drink coffee. I cannot drink coffee. I want to drink real coffee. I would love to, but I can't drink real coffee. It makes me nuts. Like this and the heart pounding and the sweats.
I
and
get the same, but that's what I, the desired effect
you
I'm going for.
You embrace that part of it.
Yeah, that's why I drink it.
I'm looking around to see if I have any, I have a lot of Funko stuff, and I keep thinking, maybe I have some Firefly stuff at home. Do they make Funko Firefly stuff?
Yeah.
I have a lot
this
of
stuff?
These guys.
Yeah.
Maybe there's
another
some...
thing I could have brought you. I got that shit.
Maybe there's a wash in there somewhere. There's probably, I'm sure I have it somewhere.
It's got like at least a cat and mouse.
at least a Mal. Nah, fuck him. It's all about Wash.
That's right.
Yeah, fuck Malcolm. That's right. Fuck Malcolm Reynolds. Fuck him. Anyway, did we start recording yet? Okay.
Don't tell. Oh, no.
Who knew? Who knew?
Look at that. It's the greatest.
Oh, yeah.
Jungle Banana?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's an old vintage, ice cream sign. And this guy was painted on glass and all sorts of fun stuff. And the wallpaper you may recognize as
yes, I
being from a Star Wars. A Star War.
Yeah. And they're
situation.
Fuzzy. I got to, it was pointed out that it's fuzzy. It's very nice. It's a very cool spot.
It's our
Ren
fun
and Stimpy.
Record. Yeah, I got the Ren and Stimpy. Got a lot of fun stuff. One of the original Nerdist pieces of art ever from when I first started it.
Cool.
Someone make that. Yeah. So it's just like a little hall. It's just a little museum of stuff, Alan. Just a little museum of things that are relevant to me.
It's
Nice.
I don't know if most people would know this or not, but you and I starred together on a situation comedy.
Yeah.
In the year 2001.
Is that when it was? Yeah, early 2001.
It was early 2001. It was that pilot season, 2001.
Wow.
I was convinced that show was going to go. I was convinced.
Man.
We had the Friends producers.
Yeah. And the Mad About You writing team was in there somewhere.
We had a Leslie Ann Warren. We had a Kathy Moriarty. We had a Dan Hedaya.
My father, which many people go, who's the perfect dad? Who's the older version of Alan Tudyk? Dan Hedaya. That Italian, overly Italian guy.
Who was it for? ABC, I think. It was ABC and those people. And I was convinced. I'm like, how is this not going to go? How is this not going to get picked up? Friends was still...
I was terrible in that. I think it got brought down by... I take full credit for that.
I highly doubt that. I was still drinking. As a matter of fact, that was one of my worst moments with drinking was going out the night before the first table read because I was so excited that I had a job, getting super drunk, and then having the phone ring, and it's like the first AD or someone, hey, are you going to show for the table read? I'm like, and I show up. It's just that nightmare. I show up and everyone's there just waiting. And they called me every morning for the rest of the week to make sure I would be there that time. It was so humiliating. Wow. Yeah. Yeah, those were dark times, Alan. But
you were very funny. I think I envied your role. You were playing the role I usually played. The
lovable fuck up.
The lovable side guy who was like the fuck up. You were the brother. You were my brother.
No responsibility in a role like that.
Absolutely.
You come in, you make your joke, people go, oh, that guy's fun, and then leave.
Yeah. And the lead has a lot. You've got to carry it. And I guess there's perks to being the lead, but...
There are, but then the lead also has to be the straight person a lot of the time, too, for the crazy characters that surround him or her jokes.
Those are the best roles.
They are good, and yes, but yeah, I don't know. It was a good time. It was a really good time. And then, you know, but if that show had gone, we wouldn't have gotten Alan Tudyk as in Firefly. Who knows what would have happened
Would there be a Nerdist?
No, definitely not.
Wow.
Because if I had been employed back then regularly, I probably wouldn't have had too much self-reflective moments of abject unemployment and rejection. So it wouldn't have occurred to me that something was wrong.
Wow, look at that. That's from the ashes, the phoenix rises.
But we've both been doing this for a really long time, and you must have you must have understood that too. I mean, your career is in... It's so beautifully blossoming right now, but I'm sure when you guys were making Con Man a few years ago, and I know you'd been working on it for a long time, it was like, I want to make a thing that's mine.
Yeah.
Because, you know, would you say it's fair to say that you were not getting the types of things that you wanted to see yourself doing at that time?
Yeah. I wanted to play the lead. I had played the lead. I mean, that was the initial impetus to write and to create something, because I have played leads in stage before, on Broadway, and could never make the jump to television or film. I was always the side character or the side character, the weird character. Usually the weird character.
Where they
go, we don't know how to cast this. Call that weird guy. And perfect.
Here comes the coffee drinks. Here's my decaf. Here's my castrated coffee beverage.
So this will be pre and post coffee. This is right now. It's still in the pre world. Post coffee, I'm just gonna light right.
You're gonna be on the ceiling like Peter Parker when Green Goblin Willem Dafoe comes over and looks for him in his room, and he's just up on the ceiling.
That's
just
me.
Hiding. Yeah,
that's me.
You.
Although I wouldn't play either of those roles. I play the wacky down the hall neighbor.
Hey, yo, Spider-Man! Yeah, hey,
that'd be the door guy who goes, "This place is getting crazy."
You gonna take the elevator this time, Spider-Man? Or you gonna take the side of the building? Whoa!
There he is! I saw you in the papers.
I know your secret, but I ain't gonna tell nobody, Spider-Man.
That's
and
my
now
boy.
Alan Tudyk is a star. He's a star. What are your now? I'm sure you're having conversations during that period where you go, "Okay, I'm not getting these roles that I want. I'm not getting these lead roles." What are your representatives telling you? What sort of math are you doing in your head to try to understand this phenomenon?
The thing that they tell you and that my representatives would always tell me is, I would get a job that was a small role, and I'd say, "I don't like this project, or I don't want to be in this. I don't." That like a project would come along that I would say, I don't want to audition, I don't want to be there. They would say, you need to take this role to get some kind of notice so we can get the next bigger role. But then it became even worse. Like the role would be so small, they'd say, take this role, and then until this movie comes out, we're going to tell everybody you're in this amazing project and lie to them basically that I'm doing something that I'm not, and try to get me a bigger role before then. It was... I just kept wanting to – I was like, I'm tired of doing things I don't want to do in hopes to do the thing I want to do one day. And I guess it's just sort of slowly built up over time. You just kind of hang in there. And Con Man changed everything. Con Man changed everything for me. I whenever I try to talk about my career, it always comes back to Con Man, which is only just 3 years old
yeah.
of when we made it.
Yeah.
And – I don't care about things anymore the way I used to. I feel like I can make something now. It changed how I see everything. It changed how I walk on set, what I think I can affect. Star Wars would not have been – K2SO would not have been K2SO if it hadn't come right after Star Wars. Because I just kind of didn't – it wasn't this, oh, my God, I've got this opportunity to make something out of this. I thought – I actually tried to turn it down.
What?
Yeah.
How? Why?
Well, When it was offered to me, Gareth Edwards offered it to me at Star Wars Celebration in Anaheim when they were there. I went and talked to him, and we had just crowdfunded. We had just raised $3.6 million, and he said, would you like to do it? I said, oh, my God. Please tell me it's not going in June, because if it's in June, I cannot do it. I'm not going to do it. He was like, well, okay. Well, it's in July. Okay, good. Because I felt like I had a responsibility to the fans who had supported it.
Oh, yeah.
And we had said, we're going to make this right away. We're not going to be one of those people who crowdfunds and you never hear
us. You can't disrespect your Kickstarter supporters.
Yeah. And so I was determined. And then I even kind of was very much saying, go over this with me again. How are we going to do this? What is my input? Because I had done iRobot before in 2004 or 2003. And right after Firefly was canceled. And that was really educational, and I feel like it doing that job kind of paid off 13 years later for Star Wars, because I think that's why they called me initially or thought of me. But I had fun. It was mainly just me, Will, and Bridget Moynihan in Vancouver for 6 months. It was great.
Everyone was nice?
Everybody was nice. We had a good time. I wore a spandex suit. It's kind of, I mean, but I worked really, really hard on that.
I hope you showed up in the spandex and said, okay, should I get into wardrobe now? I mean, that's my favorite joke. That's one of my favorite jokes. Do I need to get in? I don't know. I like stupid dad jokes. But it's so consistent that when you are, we just had the 7th anniversary of this podcast. And it was a similar thing, but when you're running around and trying to make everyone else happy and trying to, oh, what am I doing right? What am I doing? You're so concerned about that. And then you finally just kind of break and you let it all go as a rebellion. You go, well, I'm just going to make something for myself and fuck everyone.
Right.
That's when everything really starts to fall into place. I don't know if it's the secret or if it's the force or if it's just coincidence.
Yeah.
But something happens as a result of that, and things start to fall into line.
I think I see people as collaborators now that I work for, as opposed to that's my boss and I need to either please them or I want to get something out of this job or anything like that. It just becomes we're just doing the work.
Right.
Let's – of the little work I've done since, well, it's Star Wars and now Powerless, that we're just here to make it.
Yeah.
See what happens. There's so many things that go into this. And if I have an idea about writing or an idea about really anything, I don't really censor myself, and I feel free to improv in a way I never have. I always waited for permission, and you kind of had to tell me again and again. I worked with
Frank Oz directed.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, man. He directed the first Death at a Funeral. There were two. There was the British one, and then they came out right after, a year later, with a black American version with Chris Rock mm-hmm. and Martin Lawrence, and to make money, because it didn't get released here, oddly. It was all a, I don't know, studio thing that happened with MGM. And there was, he would say, Alan, now you're not giving me everything. We do it, and he'd go, give me... He'd say, show me your chops, which is the most embarrassing thing for him to say out loud, because he's like, now be really good.
Right, right, right.
And action. No, Alan, I want you to really be good now.
And it's also the voice of Miss Piggy talking to you at the same
man.
Time.
And Yoda. He spoke like Cookie Monster one day.
Oh.
He said, come over here. And he never does voices, but he just kind of did it. And I shrank to the floor. I'm crouched down. I'm like, what is this? I feel like I was trying to shrink myself to the size I was when I watched Cookie Monster.
Mm-hmm.
Well,
you know what it is? I know the feeling you're talking about, and it's such a deep developmental level of your being that you implode. Mm-hmm. It just like it's your whole body like sucks into a singularity because you can't. Like you just can't process because it there's a crazy sense memory with it that you can't quite put your finger on, and that I mean I honestly think that they should use things like that in warfare, because I think if you took like childhood icons and went into battle and did that, I think everyone would just and then you know then you capture them or whatever, but it's so disarming.
Waka, waka, waka. He could just come out and just project that on a battlefield. And what are you going to do? Miss Piggy. Ah,
did you reference that he did that, or did you just...
Yes. Not,
you did.
Yes. It was me and a couple of Daisy Donovan and... I think it was just the two of us in his trailer. And we were going to work out a scene before we did it.
Was
and,
he wearing pants? Did he weird?
I never wore pants.
Amazing. Yes. So glad to hear that.
I mean, is a diaper pants?
I mean, you know, that's a debate. Is it pants? It's sort of like it's a helper.
Yeah.
Diaper is a helper.
It's not because he was old. He just liked
no,
it.
No, yeah. It feels good. It's comfortable. It's freeing. It's a poop caddy.
Yeah.
Yeah. But you did mention...
He mentioned, he's like, oh, I never do that. Like, he was embarrassed that he did it. He's big about these characters are not to be played with, that they are characters. I did a press tour with him for Death at a Funeral. Went on a radio show, did a lot of screenings with him, and invariably someone would say, hey, could you do Yoda for me? And he'd go, and I learned to just kind of sit back and look at people like, God, you shouldn't have.
Oh, no.
Yeah, because he goes, so what, I'm like you're a little dancing monkey right now. These are characters that are built up. They're not voices. They're not party tricks. They're not parlor tricks. I'm not here to just pull something out of another project to show you while I'm here talking about this project. So, no. And we're like, hey, we're on KW whatever. And we're here with Frank Oz. Hey, Frank, do you mind doing our call letters as Yoda? Oh, no, God, Jesus. What am I, your little dancing monkey? And he just launches into his thing. Just very calmly.
See, he missed a great opportunity to say, Yoda is a puppet. I am not a puppet. Come on.
You
why
you
need, can you call him for me? We text him. We tell him
so
I said that.
You're putting your hand on my ass right now. Is that it? Make me talk. Is that how it goes?
Speakerphone. Always on speakerphone. Would you ask him to yell at me like Yoda? I mean, it's just, that's got to be like a blessing and a curse. Like, you get to touch so many people's lives and be so special, but people are always going to treat you like a fart machine, basically.
Well, yeah. They will, and he's been such an amazing director. I mean, back in the 90s, especially with What About Bob and Dirty Rotten Scoundrels, and he directed Little Shop of Horrors, the movie. Mm-hmm. That is unbelievable. And Death at a Funeral. I don't know if you've seen it. A farce, a modern-day farce.
By the way, you are now – I guess the good thing about K2's voice is that it's essentially a slightly ramped up version of you, of your voice.
Yes.
So when people say, do K2SO, you can just be like, I'm doing it now. Like, you're sort of, you don't have to go into into a zone. But I wonder if you'll get sick of it at some point.
I'll just say, I'm K2SO. I've been reprogrammed Imperial Droid. And that's going to, and now we move on.
He's doing it. Hey, could you say, you're watching WPF?
I don't care. I'll do it.
I know, I would too.
Yeah. Yep, you got it.
I have no problem with that.
King
whatsoever.
Candy, I'll do King Candy. Oh, come out and whatever you want. I was on K-Rock And they were talking about, oh, what's it like when you have you do a voice? Do you do it for kids? I was like, yeah. And at a certain age, the kids are, you know, they think it's amazing if they're a little bit older. But if they're little, they feel like they've been ripped off. They look at you like they've been betrayed because the voice is coming out of this old man.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, yes, but kids are stupid. Kids are so stupid. And my friend called me and said, you know, they're running that as just a little soundbite all week long. Kids are so stupid.
Perfect.
But that's Alan Tudyk as King Candy saying, well, kids are stupid.
But the kids are too dumb to know why that's wrong. So it's fine. It's fine. But it's, yeah, when I remember doing cartoons that do voices at Nickelodeon, they would bring kids in every so often and they stopped doing it because the kids would always get so excited and they go in there, it's just a bunch of fucking grown-ups
sitting
around and they get bored immediately.
Yeah.
And you can tell when kids are bored because they look around. You can tell when they're into something.
Yep.
And they were not into it at all. But I do think that skill set for you, I think the voiceover skill set is such a I don't think it's an underrated skill set. I don't think people go, voiceover. But it's such an incredible talent to be able to have, to be able to tell the story of a character without –
right.
Without, I mean, I know they put the visuals in. And you see what it's definitely a relationship with the artists.
Right.
But it's just, it really just depends on the quality of your performance.
It's a fun back and forth. And, you know, you mentioned sometimes you see it, sometimes it's already animated, which I can't stand that. I mean, it's my least favorite version of that because they've already decided your performance in a way where if you're doing it, you give them whatever. You have the lines. King Candy was especially this way where he could make noise and it would get animated. He would say, everybody come down here. Hello. And all of the would have, he'd notice something beside him, lean on something that's wobbly. And I loved seeing that back and forth play with the animators, what they pulled out and what they used.
Yeah.
And also something that's written angry, you can say it very sweetly. Mm-hmm. So then they animate, you know, the blinky eyes and the happy face or
But whatever. That's, you know, when you have, that was Rich Moore, correct?
Yes.
Yeah. So Rich is so fucking talented.
Funny guy.
And when you have that kind of a relationship, yeah, he's pulling off what you're, and then you'll go in and do ADR and it's like, oh, they added stuff. No, you add more stuff. And it really does become kind of an improv, like
yep.
A certain level of it. When you have a good director like Rich is an improv game, especially, oh, we're going to one up in this way. What do you got?
And he champions his actors. He tried, I had a joke in Wreck-It Ralph, a race riot joke.
Oh, no.
And he fought for it. It was when Wreck-It Ralph is coming. He's just come out of this toffee moat thing or little pond, and he starts destroying the race, and he upends all the stands. We're there for the Ross, the race, to see who's going to win and who's going to place. And everybody starts screaming and running around, and King Candy says, stop it, please, everybody. We don't want a race riot on our hands because it's a race, and you ride, never mind. And it was something that I came up with there, and he was like, oh, that's good. Played it in I think, New Mexico at one screening. Everybody was silent and uncomfortable, and that was it.
That was about it.
Yep, yep. Race riot got
listen.
We,
it's
got
still
pulled.
For us. It's still for us. We still get that moment.
Yeah.
But I think it, you know, sort of hearing Up to Con Man, everything before, and I think there really is something to the when you're kind of exuding a bit of desperation,
mm-hmm.
people can tell. It just you can just tell.
Yeah.
And when that goes away, and that usually goes away when you're kind of just focused on your own thing and you're comfortable, there's some weird law of attraction where it's like, I guess when you really think about it, from an evolutionary standpoint, if an organism is desperate, it needs something. And if it needs something, it might not be strong enough to survive on its own, which means it's going to take from the group. So the group probably shuns it. You know what I mean?
Yes.
But when something doesn't need anything, oh, that thing must have answers. I need answers, you know?
Right.
So I really think there's something to that idea.
I absolutely agree. You are... You don't need them. You don't need people. You can... you have to fight for your vision of a thing, and there's plenty of people fighting against you. that I never, as an actor, there would just be one or two moments where I'm like, please, I really feel like I need to say this, or this is what this moment should be. But usually it'd be like, this is what this moment is, great. I'll fulfill what you want in this moment as an actor, as to a director or to a writer, whatever. This is what it needs to be. Then let me make it that, the best version of that for you. Whereas, doing Con Man, I had to, especially trying to get it made, people would say, all right, this is about conventions. This is about a guy going through Comic-Cons or lesser conventions, and he doesn't like his experience. They'll go, oh, yeah, cons, great. Crazy characters, those nerds.
Right.
Oh, my God, let's make fun of them.
Right.
And then it would be over. You're like, you don't – try to explain it to them. Yeah. They don't get it. But also, my agents left – because I was determined to make Con Man, and I had a test for an ABC show, and they wait till right at the last minute to say, oh yeah, also Alan wants to do this Con Man thing, and he's been pursuing it. He has he's about to make it with somebody else. We came really close to making it with different production companies and different ways, and they said, oh, no, this is direct competition with ABC at the time. We consider online direct competition now, and so he can't make it. And this is an hour and a half before I tested. It was me and a guy, and it was looking good. And I was on my way to the test saying, all right, well, I just need to do the pilot then. Let me just make the pilot and do it with my own money and put it on YouTube. I just have to see this thing through. And they went back, and I'm sitting in line waiting to go into the gate. I had two cars back from the gate, and I got a call saying, they won't do it. I said, then I'm not doing it.
Well, good for you.
I turned around.
And that kind of bullshit business affairs nonsense is infuriating to me, because anyone with a fucking brain in their head would know that it's not the fucking 80s, and that kind of competition does not make sense anymore. It's
right.
Like, if you're on an ABC show and you make Con Man and Con Man blows up, guess what's going tandem with all the attention you're getting? Your fucking ABC show.
Yeah.
And then, especially in today's crowded press marketplace, that's more things for you to talk about, which makes you more of a story. This shit fucking incenses me to no end when I hear this. Like, do you guys not fucking know how the world works now? Listen. If you had gotten it, who knows if you would be here? Who knows if there would be K2SO?
Right.
But on your behalf, that makes me very angry.
It was very frustrating. And yeah, it's still. Luckily, with Powerless, which I'm doing now for NBC, I was able to. I'd already made one season of Con Man, so I was able to, before signing any contracts, said, look, this thing exists. And when it exists beforehand, then they have to either accept it or walk away.
I wonder what the competition is now for the show that probably didn't get picked up.
Oh, it did.
It got
picked up and lasted two seasons.
Okay, well, I guess that kills that idea then.
Yeah, no, it did. It lasted its own little while, but it cleaned house. My lawyers I walked away from. My agents ended up saying, "Look, it's over."
Really?
Yeah. The next pilot season. It took another year of us not really getting along, and the next pilot season, they said, "You really need to do a pilot this year." I said, I'm not, because I hadn't done comment yet. I'm like, we're almost ready.
That's fantastic. So what is driving you at this point? What is it when everything about, you know, the Alan Tudyk of, let's say, even 10 years ago, 6 years ago,
right,
might have been like, all right, I guess I better do what they're telling me to do. They're the experts. I need to work. Like,
right.
What is it when you know you're not working and you know that all of this is your potential career, your representatives, what's driving you to still make this thing?
Ego. That I'm such a comedy snob that I would read other pilots and tend to be like, this isn't as funny as my thing. I think my thing's funnier. So I'm not interested in making this. And I've always been a frustrating client for agencies when they say, this is the thing that everybody's going to watch. But it's not funny. It's not any good. Like, it will be good. That's a big thing. I don't think people know that. You get a script and it's terrible. And they say, yeah, but look who's in it. It's going to be good by the time you're done.
Right.
It's such a like, but I got to sign a 7-year contract for something that may or may not be good. So I would, I just said no. I said no. Plus, I've gone to cons for so long now, and I wanted to make it for years, 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 years. I wanted to make a movie, actually, and then it got sort of figured out a way to make it in TV. And I just felt like there was an audience for it, and people were missing the audience for it, And if I didn't make it, somebody else was going to make it. So you have that, like, I got to do it.
I don't know if they would have made it the right way. I mean, I know, you know, for years I had heard some version of, like, let's do a thing at a Comic-Con. It was never very clear what that thing was, but it was that same, these nerds, they're characters. And then, you know, when I would always say, like, yeah, but you can't ridicule, like,
right.
You have to be on their side. It can't be like, look at these dumb nerds in their stupid costumes, you know, because that's completely disrespectful to what we do. And so, you know, there are certainly ways to play with the environment as long as it's like we're all a part of this.
Yeah. There was one joke in the first season that I think we – this is where I looked at – this is where I think we did it in this moment where like sort of straddled those two worlds. I meet a lot of fans who come to me in a very serious – it's a very serious moment, one of my favorite moments when they say, look, your work in Firefly – it's usually Firefly – helped me get through Afghanistan or a surgery or something that's so life-changing and monumental, and it's like hugs and tears and amazing that I got to be a part of that somehow. So in Con Man, why not have a laugh at that? There's a character who comes up and says, your show, and he's dressed like a tooth fairy. Greg Wilson, really funny guy. Your show helped me forget what happened to my village. I burned it down. you get the sense it was on purpose. So it nods to that moment that it's beautiful, that it helped him through a time, but he's the reason everything went bad. We had him on second season too. He's the biggest fan. And we just make fun of him needing his medicine and not being able to get it. Anyway, it's a very ripe world to play in.
I was so bummed that because we met with you at Nerdist about Con Man.
That's right.
Before the Kickstarter.
Yes.
And at that point, we had just been purchased by Legendary.
Oh, dude.
And so they had our purse strings. So this guy was there.
I know.
Who I don't think really understood nerd culture
or
at
you.
All.
Or you.
No.
He didn't know what he had.
No. And so it was one of those things where, you know, I remember meeting with him and he's like, well, I think... I go, you know, this feels like the right take on this. And I love Alan. I've known Alan. I love Nathan. And it's a great group. And he's like, well, it just, you know, they just want more money than – it was one of those, like, they just want more money to make it than they're ever going to get kind
right.
of thing. And so I was like, okay. I mean, I literally couldn't do anything about it. And then you did the Kickstarter. And I think I even said to you after Kickstarter, I go, it's so much better that you did the Kickstarter because you got more money than I think – we even would have been able to squeeze out of them.
Yeah.
So, and also the story of it was so much better that it's a show about fandom that was supported by fans.
Right.
And I think that helped spiritually kickstart the project and get right. people interested as opposed to just, oh, we made this, a company paid for it, you know? So right. I actually, as bummed as I was to not be able to get to work on it, I think it worked out so much better that way.
They're in it. Fans are in it. And it's you can watch. If you watch the series, you can watch like, oh, those are the same fans as the other con they were at. And there's a few of them where it's a Where's Waldo. You don't even have to – it's not a very challenging game because there's certain people who are always front and center that would show up and be extras for us.
Yeah, that right after you guys funded and you were – I don't know if – I guess maybe you had shot, but you brought footage to Comic-Con.
Right.
And I moderated that panel.
Yes.
And I think you were the first internet-based production that got into Hall H.
Dude, that was cathartic. That was beautiful, man. I couldn't believe it. Couldn't believe it. Yeah. I was crying on the way to I was crying on the way to Comic-Con because we had just finished the first season and it was so hard. I directed every episode. I wrote every episode. It was more challenging than anything I'd ever done. And I was in the car with my wife. She was driving because I was just too exhausted to drive. And some song came on and I just started crying because I was so afraid of how it would go and exhausted. And wow, it was a... I just found a video that I did in my hotel room before Hall H where I was like, okay, this is what I think it's going to be, and I'm really nervous. I look like a wreck. Anyway, it was a very important weekend. thank you for moderating it. That was one of the cool things about it. It was like, this is really legit.
It was
on
great.
Every level.
Is there, then that's where the guys got engaged, right?
Oh, yes.
The Billy.
They're going to be at your taping of At Midnight tonight.
Holy shit.
Billy and Barry.
Oh, my God. That was such a beautiful moment to get. Do you want to give a little bit of the backstory on that?
Billy Brooks does all of our vis effects, and Barry does makeup, and he did a couple of zombies eating churros in one of the episodes. And so they both worked on Con Man, or part of the family of Con Man, really amazing guys. And they got engaged in Hall H after we had introduced it. We had talked to everybody, and I said, don't ask Billy any questions or Barry. And he had already said before, and he's like, I don't think I want to go up on the panel because nobody asks questions of the VisiVex guy. So I just become somebody who just sits up there and never does anything. I'm like, no, it's going to be different. It's going to be different. So don't ask them any questions. So he was over there kind of getting angry.
Because he didn't know why he was up there.
No, I was there.
And it was the last question.
Yeah.
Right.
And then you said, you gave it to me. I remember introducing them and saying, hey, Barry wants to ask you something, Billy. And they came out in front of the dais.
Oh, as soon as that happened, and you could, as soon as the moment turned and everyone knew exactly what was about to happen, the place went fucking nuts.
Yeah, it was beautiful, and they're married now and wear rings. And I just saw them yesterday.
Ah, it's great.
Yeah,
I like those guys. Yeah, they're Walking Dead fans. So we talk. You know, when I run into them, they talk about Walking Dead. But it was a perfect end to this really like special homegrown. Homegrown thing that you guys made, and I mean, now season two, you have season two of Con Man.
It's out on Comic-Con HQ, another streaming service out there. We're sort of their premiere show, I believe. That's not wrong to say. They're of three shows that they have right now. We're the one that
a flagship or a tent pole.
There we
if
go.
You will.
We are a tent pole.
Yeah.
Of a many poled tent as it's growing. But yeah, that's where it lives. Lionsgate picked it up. So we made the first season, said this is what it looks like, and then as opposed to doing it with Legendary, where they would be shaping it, they'd be in the room saying it needs to be this.
Right.
That we made it, and then that's the benefit of that also, that they come in and go, do it like you did it before. It's crazy, man. They gave me artistic license to do second season. Like they had some great notes, but one or two of them I didn't want to do. And so I could just say, I don't want to do number 6 and number 8. And they had to go, you got it.
Good. That's what's supposed to happen.
It's doing a network show with Powerless. I know that it doesn't happen like that.
It can be tricky, you know, when, part of the allure of going, of doing like a, either a cable show, because I was just talking about this with someone about Basket, Zach Galifianakis'
right.
show.
Right.
Which is also, I mean, Zach's amazing because, you know, he's a big star. And like, what do you want to do? I want to do an intimate show about a guy a who's a clown. But it's this really beautiful comedy, family, drama. And, you know, how do you pitch that? You know, there's no way to really pitch that because it's so tonally specific. And Louis C.K. is one of the executive producers. And it's like, yeah, when you empower funny, creative people to carry out their vision and there's not so much oversight or it's like, well, the network's got to weigh in and now the studio's got to weigh in and now marketing's got to – like everyone's got to put their little thing in it.
Yep.
And then, you know, ultimately they just – you know, they just make the color brown. You know what I mean? It's like when you put too much paint in, it's like, oh, a little bit.
Yeah,
right. Oh, now it's just this color again. Okay, let's try. Oh, now I just too many colors. Now it's just this color again.
That was Firefly, man. They came in and stuck their thumb on this. They just because they showed our we don't like the pilot. The 2-hour pilot sets up the whole world. Yeah, no, we don't like it. We want to do episode 2 first, and we need it by Monday, and it was a Thursday. And then Joss and Tim Minear scrambled and wrote what became The Train Job. And that was our first episode. Showed it all out of order. The last episode they showed was the pilot.
Oh, my gosh.
Took us off the air, put us on the air, took us off the air. Showed an Adam Sandler movie from a decade prior. Like, they were just – it was so bizarre. But they didn't like the show. Oddly, I pitched Con Man to Gail Berman, who was the person who was who canceled it. Canceled Firefly. I went into Berman Braun and she said, hey, and she's in defense of her, well, she defends herself. So she came in and they said, Alan, this is Gail. And she goes, oh, no, I know Alan. Because I canceled Firefly.
She said that?
Yeah.
She Holy said, shit.
She said, I've done a lot of things. Because she was she was so amazing out of the gate. She produced these big hits on Broadway and then got pulled in. And she was kind of a hit maker and put Joss on the air with Buffy the Vampire Slayer, championed him, Angel. So she's responsible for those. It wasn't for Gail Berman, in her defense, those things wouldn't be on the air, and they wouldn't have so much love, and all of those stories wouldn't have been told. And then she put Firefly on the air and didn't like it, and she canceled it. And she said, you know, on my Wikipedia page, they say a lot of nice things, but there's always a couple of sentences that are reserved for you. She's the one responsible for canceling Firefly, and if you take them down, they just come right back up. I said, well, you're going to love this idea. It's about a guy who was on a TV show that got canceled. It was canceled too soon. It was a sci-fi show. But then she left Berman Braun, and it became Whale Rock, and now she works at Fox again, I think.
Oh, wow.
Crazy business.
It is, but it's all, you know, everything that you do today and are capable of today is the cumulative effect of all of those things. So, you almost can't even ever really look back and go, oh man, I really, it's like, yeah, but there wouldn't be this, and there wouldn't be Con Man, and there wouldn't be Rogue One with you in it, and there wouldn't be, you know, everything else that you're doing. And so it really, those are really just the skill set building years. And if you can remember that, and it's real hard to do it when you're in it, because it just feels real, it just feels like you can feel the valley when you're in it.
Yep.
But, you know, if you can stick it out and learn from it and keep trying and keep trying, you climb your way back up, you know.
That meant to be thing that people always say. It's meant to be. And that's the Band-Aid you put on it. You know, all this failure or all this hardship right now, they'll say, look, it was meant to be. That show shouldn't have gone. I know it feels rough right now, but it's meant to be. There's something else around the corner, and it's so hard to swallow. But I don't know what else you're going to do. It is meant to be. 13 years after iRobot, K2SO.
So are you done shooting Con Man Season 2?
Yeah.
Done shooting?
Yeah.
I feel like you need to make a video or something as that character and just be like, what happened to me? You know, like maybe he has a song or some sort of, he's trying to make a comeback or something.
I made the character of Jerry Lansing, played by Nolan North, is one of the funniest guys. Big.
A huge voiceover guy, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Drake on, Nathan Drake on whatever that show.
Uncharted.
Uncharted, yeah. Anyway. Xbox guy. So he hates Andy Serkis. He's the second best motion capture artist in the world.
Oh, his character.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, I took my experience and then amplified it 120%. So he hates Andy Serkis just as monkeys. Gollum was a shaved down gibbon and he does all the things that he has such a chip on his shoulder. That's Nolan's line. He's very funny. He's very, very funny. But he does all the. He did. He got his break being the feather in Forrest Gump. Right at the beginning of the. He did. It was a beautiful ballet of. I don't remember. It ends up in diabetes. Ultimately, a story of diabetes brought on by too much chocolate. Yeah. The kitten that says, hang in there. That was me. Meow, meow. I did print work back then. So. That came out of that. Like everything, I get to exercise a lot of my stuff.
It feels good too to be able to, because at least if you can do something with it, you kind of take ownership over it, and it means that you've grown from it. You know, I mean, when you're, I think it's fine to go through periods where you sit around and go, fuck, I don't know, maybe I don't know. You know, as long as you can get out of it and do something constructive with it afterwards. But it's a bummer when, you know, talented people just get stuck in that place.
Yeah,
and then. For years, and you go, well, I love that person. How come they don't work more? And then they get a job, and it makes them a little crazy. And you're like, oh, that's okay. All right.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. You might be a little part of the problem there. So the just being able to kind of keep focused, and you know, it's not easy. It's not easy to not go nuts because it is a business that cannot wait to reject you at every turn.
Yep. I've been lucky that I have a lot of. Outlets that I can kind of. I started in the theater, so when everything, you know, when I get frustrated on one, hopefully one of the others will open up like voiceover or theater, little films or big films, or just sort of find a little spot somewhere to keep me going, to keep me exercising as a worker. I consider myself just a working worker, worker actor.
But don't you feel like, I mean, so being at the Rogue One premiere was one of my favorite cinematic experiences of all time because of how just the energy in the theater was unlike anything. And, you know, people get excited at premieres because they've got people there worked on it. And, oh, they applaud when they see names. But legitimately, people were fucking losing their mind. I was talking about this with Fillion when he was on a few weeks ago. And the energy – and as soon as it was over, I ran up to him and I was like, oh, my God. Tudyk, like, fucking steals every scene he's in. He fucking steals every – and he goes, you know, he improvised a lot of that. And I go, oh, what? Fuck. Holy shit. And, you know, so it was – I didn't want to overwhelm you at the premiere because it was just that moment where everyone was coming up and, like, you know, that was so much your moment. I mean, it's such a triumphant, like a moment that is just rare in our in a career.
Yeah.
And it was so, like, you're just a part of this thing now. And not only are you a part of it, but it's really you. Like, you made it that. That's fucking incredible.
Yeah, I guess. Yeah. Well, we all did, you know, truly. Like, Diego Luna's very funny, and so we would always play back and forth with Diego. The thing where I slap him, which was my favorite in that movie, he had, for some reason, because the script was shifting, sort of in the middle, it shifted, and he had a thing on his lip, and he's like, there's a scene where I have this hit on my lip from something else. I got hit in the face. Now that the way the script is, that's not going to make any sense. He's like, I need to get hit in the face to make that make sense. Can K2 hit me in the face? Just slap me? And they didn't want to give it to him. They're like, no. And he's like, just give me one time. And they said, all right. And so we put it in, and I slapped him. And then one of my favorite things was, and there's a fresh one if you mouth off again. And when they put that in, I couldn't believe that they put that in. Like, a joy doesn't get to say that. And that was just me playing with Diego, and actually you can see a couple of frames of him. He puts his hand over his face because he's about to laugh, and it's actually in the movie of him about to bust in the movie.
So you were in a mocap suit for the whole
and on stilts, and the way that ILM has it, it was so freeing. They didn't have balls, and there weren't dots on my face because of his the way that K2's face worked. They didn't need all of that contour, and I mainly just wore a cap, stilts, and I would just turn the cap backwards and put on this little beanie hat on top of it. And
no makeup or anything?
No makeup.
Shit rolling in?
Yeah. I had this little backpack with a head that telescoped up, but they got rid of that. For running, I didn't have to wear that anymore. They're like, we can just take your movement and stretch it out and put it on him where his legs, the way his legs move and the way his hands move.
So how much of it was... when you started, did you sort of feel that freedom? Did Gareth say, hey, you know, I really want you to be you and play around with this? Or did you grow into that as the film went on?
I think I always did because it just came off of Con Man. And I was I wasn't stepping on anybody's toes in Con Man because they were all my toes. So I was comfortable, and it was reflexive to me to be in a situation and go, you know what, this is better if we say this or do this. And he was very encouraging of that. And then by the end, after they started to, before the reshoots, the K2 was doing well in the test audiences. They were like, this line doesn't really work. What do you have? What else do you have? And so I would just run through pitches. How about this? How about this? How about this? Like the one where she says at the end, or where K2 says, Jen, I'll be with you. Cassian says, I have to. That the line was that she says, or somebody, I think it, anyway, somebody says, grab anything that isn't nailed down. My line was, well, I'm not nailed down, so I guess I'll grab myself. I was like, gugh, this line is rough. I'm like, what do you got? And I pitched that, and the producer liked it, and I did it. It was kind of pushed back, like, don't do that. I talked to the director, and I was like, nah, that doesn't work. What else you got? And did it anyway. And that's the one they used, and it got good laughs in the
theater. Every time he was on screen, you're right. I know it was a team effort of a lot of people, and so I have huge props to Gareth and the editors,
right.
Because comedy isn't anything if it's not captured and presented in the right way. Like,
right.
You can say a million hilarious things, but if they don't get the timing of it, or they don't, you know.
Right.
So it was definitely a collaborative effort. But yeah, every time you were on screen, and that's kind of a tough character to pull off, because with a snarky character, you know, sometimes in a movie you can see, like, the first couple times around, people are like, oh, that's so great. And after a while you're like, Jesus Christ, when is this fucking guy going to shut up, you know? But it never happened with K2.
Yeah.
So how did you keep that balance of still managing to keep him likable,
right,
but still snarky?
I think he loved casting. Maybe that was it. God, you know, that was the one connection. You know, it was about fathers, you know, Jin's father and all of that connect, you know, sort of figuring out who her father was. And Cassie, to me, was my father. I don't know. Maybe. He just sort of played, you know, this in Powerless, I've been asked a couple of questions. Like, are you all winking at the camera? Like, oh, they're superheroes. And I'm wink, wink. Like, you can't do that. You have to play it real. And I think that was it. Just playing him like the child he was. There's so much room in that character. The first time Cassie comes in and says, I see you've met K2. And she says, yeah, he's charming. He says, I'm sorry. You know, he doesn't even know what I said. He's apologizing for me without knowing what I said. So it gives me this huge, it gives me so much room to just say whatever the hell I wanted to. And I don't know. He's protecting Cassian. He liked his life before Jin came along, before all these people showed up. He'd rather just work with Cassian. I don't know. I guess that might be it.
Have you gotten any... have you started to get the calls like, oh, they want you to come in and narrate Star Tours. Oh, they want you to say, thank you for coming to the Disneyland Hotel.
Right.
This is Kit. You know, it's like you... Because you are that guy now.
Right.
Even though I mean, look, he dies in the movie, but... Spoiler. But he's a robot.
Yeah.
So of all the characters that could be repaired...
Right.
I'm there, man. The whole planet blew up, but that doesn't...
They're doing prequels of everything now, so I would love to see plenty of him. I'd love to do something with Cassian, more with Cassian, or also Krennic, since I was formerly in the Empire. Like, what was the story of K2 while he was in the Empire? How did he become who we know him to be? That would be cool. But see, when characters die, I'm always pitching more for him. When King Candy died, John Lasseter, I'm like, John, listen, let's put out an album of vaudeville songs with King Candy. I'm telling you, I got a whole list of them. I got a whole bunch of those.
Why don't you just do that and then just put it out? And if they say anything, go, oh, I'm sorry. It was just a fan piece. I'm like, who's going to stop you from doing that? Especially now, who's going to stop you from doing that? No one would stop you from doing that.
Disney lawyers. An army of Disney lawyers.
It doesn't matter. Like, once it's out,
right,
you can go, okay, I'm sorry, I'll take it down. But it's fucking out. Like, and then... You know, you would do that knowing that when you took it down and said, I'm sorry, guys, they asked me to take this down, 10,000 other sites would like it spring up. They'd never. It's like an impossible game of whack-a-mole.
Well, we did a musical in Comment Season 2. So John Dinerstein, who did that, he's got the whole setup. I could just go to his house. I was a big fan of vaudeville, huge fan of early TV before the internet existed. I would go to the Museum of Radio and Television and watch the show of shows and watch Jack Benny. I love Jack Benny. Yes, and just those long takes to the audience where he could fill that. He had the longest pause but also laughter on the radio. He held the record for – he was a stingy. His character was that he was very stingy. And the line was, your money or your life. And then it was just a pause while he considered it.
I'm thinking.
Yeah.
Yeah.
yeah. Wait, or yeah, it was, yeah. There's a little, yeah, but it's I'm thinking.
I honestly think, you know, what we could do is King Candy and K2SO.
A duet.
Or it's, you know, maybe K2's early life was being, you know, like he was in the service of King Candy. And then just the two of them being roommates, you know?
K2, fix my car. Like, see, I can't go back and forth real easy. I don't want to fix your car. See, I can't go back and forth. I could do maybe the Duke of Wesselton because I did, you know, I've convinced, either they convinced themselves, I don't know who convinced who, that they put me in all their movies now. I've done five, the last five. Fuck. I did Frozen, I did the Duke of Wesselton, And then after that, oh, I did Big Hero 6, where I'm just myself with just a little bit more.
Loved Big Hero 6.
Yeah. Oh, it's, and now I'm doing they're doing a cartoon of it, so I'm get to play Cray, Alistair Cray. And then in Zootopia, I have to take Claritin to do it. Because he's so high up. The weasel. What do you say? What do you know? And then I was the rooster in Moana.
That's what's hard to... I feel like some people you go, oh, that's that person in there. But you are invisible in the sense that there was a couple in there that I didn't know. Like, oh, shit. So what is it that did you... I mean, I guess, is it theater training?
It was improv in Dallas, Texas. Sean Petrello taught me a lot. Rubber Chicken. You know, those names of improv troops. Ours was Rubber Chicken in Dallas. And he taught me a lot. He really did. I always did voices as a kid. And then my first job in the theater that kind of broke me, got me to where I was castable, was called Bunny Bunny, that Alan Zweibel wrote about Gilda Radner. And it was Paula Kael played Gilda Radner and Bruno Kirby, currently passed. We don't know if he's still. He's dead.
He's no longer alive.
And then I played 24 roles in the play. I came on as a French waiter who would come in and say, what can I... And I had a bit about pulling an invisible hair out of my mouth. I'm sorry. What can I... Hold on. Pardon. And then I run off stage and I come on as Big Bone Judy, who just lost her boyfriend. Do you mind if I just stick around? And then I was this guy. It was a little racist. Then I played a cab driver who hated them and was hungry.
Also racist.
Yeah, also racist. But it was the 90s. It was 97. And I won an award. Alice and Janney and I won for best theater debut that year. The Clarence Derwin Award, which is a prestigious award. Alice and Janney, that's... Her career is... She's done well.
She's done all right, that Alice and Janney.
My God, she's so much fun to watch on stage.
Great. She's great.
I actually... The last job I had, my regular job, I was working at a transvestite bar for Bridge and Tunnel Transvestites on 10th Avenue called Carla's 2, T-O-O. And I had a girlfriend who was on Broadway with Alice and Janney. And she said, let's all come... We're all going to come down to your... dive bar, because we all think that's cool. I was like, this is not that kind of dive bar. There was Chi-Chi the Bitch. It was a moment where I thought, I could stay in this job and write a book, or I can quit. And I quit after one shift. But Alice and Janney, I was serving her martinis, vodka martinis, and that same year, I won the Clarence Derwin Award with her.
Holy shit.
Like, it was a crazy, because the play, that play, Bunny Bunny, was waiting for a theater. We had done it in Philadelphia, and we were waiting, sort of circling. There's only so many off-Broadway theaters, and then the Lucille Lord Tell opened up, and I quit, and that was that.
So you have kind of an iron will. I mean, to make this thing that was difficult to make, that you've been pitching for years, to turn down stuff, what do you attribute that to? I mean, what is it? What is it? I mean, to have the confidence in your own stuff to say, I just believe that this is good and it should be made and I'm not going to do anything else I don't want to do. I mean, how did you not fall into the typical trappings?
Yeah, I was at a dead end, man. I have a lot of stories about getting to the between me, you know, it's between me and a couple guys and the director confiding in me. I can't cast you. You're not a big enough name.
Yeah.
You haven't done it. You haven't done enough. The right things. And I've watched a lot of people make their own things and go just zoom past me and make a name for themselves. And I've always wanted to make something. And even things I got, it was always a struggle. A Death at a Funeral. That was right down to the wire. And it was because Frank Oz was just really fighting for me every day, and they luckily listened to him, because I showed up on set while they had already been in rehearsal, and because he fought down to the wire. It was great. It was so I was at the dead end. I'm like, I'm always gonna play the guy who's the role that isn't big enough to attract an actual star. So maybe, and it's always a specialty. Does he have an accent? Oh, you know, Alan does accents, or he's a robot. So no big star wants to do that because they're not going to be seen. That was iRobot, I feel like, was kind of, it didn't attract people. Or the pirate in Dodgeball. People couldn't really wrap their heads around being a pirate in a Dodgeball movie. Like, all right, I'll give it a shot. Yarr. And then I got that specialty role. But it was, because I hid in movies, I could never, you know, he's the gay German. And then I would get a lot of, 28 Days, one of the first roles I ever played, Gerhard Weinacht. Who was wonderful and very emotional. And then I got a lot of offers to play flamboyant characters like that, and I didn't want to do any of them, so I turned them all down. So I could never – I never capitalized on any success.
Well, it just wasn't sticking to one thing. It's
I
don't want to be that guy who does – you know, you want to try different things. You want to try new – Did you ever pry Frank Oz for any Muppet stories, or did you talk to him about any of that, or is it – Is that kind of a... He doesn't really talk about that.
I did ask him about Jim Henson. Because didn't they do Menomina? That was my dance. That was my first dance with my wife last year.
Was it really?
Yeah. Menomina. It's just... I think that is the perfect song. It is the perfect song. It's the perfect comedy bit. Ugh, because it's all in the timing. But you even know the timing because it's a song. But it's phenomena. That's it.
But also the use of the, and you can hear it in the audio recording of it too, but it's the use of dimension, because when he appears way in the back and you hear the echo, like you just, it's so gorgeously timed.
Yeah. It brings me great joy. So they created that. I asked him about Jim Henson. I won't tell any of the answers I got, but we did talk about it, you know, that they had started this. It was like a couple of hippies with puppets.
Yeah.
And were Muppets, but they and Jim Henson really took him under his wing. You know, they worked together, and they created something that has changed lives. Gosh, think about that. I mean, Grover, he's Animal, he's Fozzie Bear, Miss Piggy, Cookie Monster, Yoda. I'm sure. Oh, he was also Sam the Eagle. When he laughs, he sounds like some kind of version between Fozzie Bear and Miss Piggy in real life. It's this weird, like, whoa, what's going on there?
They transported together?
Yeah.
Came out spliced together?
And he also says, he contends that he doesn't know what's funny. I'm like, what are you talking about? You know what's funny. No, I absolutely do not know what's funny. Well, I know what's funny. So you have to know more than me. You don't know what's funny, Alan.
Well, how does he attribute anything they did if he doesn't know what's funny?
He says that when they did Dirty Rotten Scoundrels, they were doing it going, we don't know anything if this is going to play or not. And then when they played it, it was...
Fuck, that movie holds up so well.
Yeah. How do you not know with Steve Martin in the basement hitting his patch eye with a fork with a cork on the end or something?
Yeah, but again, you know, but that is a tribute to a good director... Is that if there's too much hitting the fork in the eye, like,
right.
You know, because I'm sure they had takes that where he didn't nail it.
Right.
And, you know, just being able to pepper that in the right way and cover it in the right way and the right camera angle, you know, the DP and then the editing, and then Rubrick, don't make me get the genital cuff, you know, like it's just those little moments.
That's a good band name.
The Genital Cuff.
We are Genital Cuff. Our first song, Chafing. He helped me back in that I can tell it was a testament to his direction that I was playing somebody who was on acid and ketamine and all these things in one, and I end up naked, and that he would be like, nope, Alan, pull back. There's definitely a very bad performance you can edit. That in that movie, and he saved me from that, and it helped him, and also put me in only a certain amount. He's like, you can't put too much of that character in the movie because he's so potent and big and crazy that you have to space him out.
I know you've told the story several times, but I just in case people here haven't heard it yet, the thing, what did Anthony Daniels say to you?
Oh yeah,
after he saw the movie.
Fuck you. And then he said some really nice things. I have to say, he's such a funny guy. He's a gangster, man. He said really nice things. And he said, if you tell anyone I said that, I'll deny it.
Oh, that's
like,
really
so
sweet.
I can tell people you said, fuck you, absolutely. Because right before I did it, I'd met him early on. He had come down to the set because he was in it. You know, it was a big secret that he was there. And he said, so are you wearing the costume? Are you motion capturing? I said, motion capturing, you shit. And that was my only back and forth with him. And then when I saw him at the premiere in L.A., he hadn't seen the movie yet. And I saw him on the aisle as I was going down to sit down in my seat. And said hello. And he said, I'll give you notes afterwards.
Oh, that's fucking hilarious.
And afterwards, he just looked at me and shook his head and gave me a hug and said, fuck you.
So what is going through your head when you're in that theater? And I know you felt the energy in that theater. What is it? What are you feeling? And how do you even process? Like, how do you process a moment like that?
I don't. I haven't yet. I feel like I haven't yet. Because I was editing Con Man season 2 during that time, and Powerless was about to happen. We just finished Con Man season 2. I'm doing Powerless now, working 12-hour days, 5 days a week, and I'm like, this is a vacation. There's nothing to do. All I do is show up, act, which is so easy, based compared to showing up, doing 17-hour days every day for 9 months. Good God, man. We didn't have a production company. I'm such a whiner about it.
You kids.
It was me and
your production companies.
PJ Harzma, who did all, he and I did a lot of it. And we made a comic book. We wrote a comic book. We have two issues out and a game, Con Man the Game, which was massive. Right after that Hall H thing, season 1, we went up to Quebec and met with the big company we were working with to... Let's use this character. I want to have this quality in it. It's you build your own Comic-Con. And so all this stuff was happening at once. And so it was crazy. And so I was shooting Powerless while I was going and doing press for Star Wars. And that was a tough juggle for time. So for me, it was just getting to have fun and hang out with Ben Mendelsohn. And I mean, the best actors, like my favorite actors, were in that movie. So
had you seen it before? You must have done some ADR here and there, but did you see it in its entirety until?
No. I got to see that last, when I did some ADR, they're like, check out what we, because that last thing with Darth Vader wasn't on there.
Oh.
They put that on really close to the end. And they're like, look what we did.
I was like, oh my God.
Oh my God. The moment where they're looking at the door, excuse me, and you know that Darth Vader's, you can hear him breathing, and then his lightsaber goes, and he's in the room with them. And then he's such a badass, more than you've ever seen him be a badass, sticking people on the ceiling and choking people from across the room and throwing people around, because now we have the ability to do that. Oh my God, my head's tingling right now, because it was very, 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 very exciting to me. And it didn't come out that everybody died, which I loved the whole time when we were making it. I go, everybody dies. So great. I saw Mark Hamill at a con, and I went up to him and said, hi, Mark. I don't mean to interrupt you. He was signing. My name's Alan Tudyk. I'm K2. And he goes, oh, my God. Got up. Like, fans all just had to wait. Pulled me in to a really close. He had his arm around me. He's like, I cannot believe everybody dies. I mean, what the hell? Everybody dies. I was like, yeah, that's my favorite part, because it's so touching.
Well, he said Gareth told him that.
Yep.
And he was like, why did you tell me that? Like, he didn't want to know what happened spoiled.
Everything was so secret for the first one that they made for The Force Awakens. So secret. They had a safe, evidently. Like, it was, I think, Mental Games, a safe that you could read the script for people who had to read it. That you pull it out, you read it in the room, and you have to put it back. Whereas we, like right in the beginning, said, or Felicity said, I need a script. Because we had these tablets that you had to access and all this stuff, and that's how you got your script. She's like, no, we need scripts. We're actors and we need scripts. We need to mark on them and have scripts in our hands. And Gareth went, yeah, here you go.
Great.
So they were just scripts, and they didn't really keep track of them.
And it was fine.
And it was fine. And they didn't get out. And he would show sections of it to the whole crew, to anybody who wanted to come in. He'd show, like, this is where we went to Jeddah. Check this out.
Well, I think Rogue One was essential in the evolution of this expanding universe because, you know, I think Force Awakens pulled everyone back in. Ah, remember this? This is the thing. Great. But Rogue One said, and we're going to break the rules, you know, and we're going to fuck with it, and we're going to try stuff, and we're going to kill people, and we're going to, you know. But even just to the extent of, I honestly think one of the biggest gifts of that movie was to strengthen Episode 4 in ways where you're like, oh, that's what, you know, like even though you know it's kind of retcon or whatever, like it's still... It just clicked everything so beautifully. And, that's the moment right before. Oh, and those are all the people that died. Oh, fuck! You know, it's like, you can't. And the Death Star is because that's why it's so easy. God damn it! You know, it's like those moments.
Yeah, they got to go back and sew up anything. Ah, so cool. I guess I'll get it at a certain point. I need to watch it again. After I first watched it, I remember being just alone in my house going, I'm K2SO. Oh, my God. I'm K2SO. What a cool character to get to be. Even though we did it, and I was there, it was just, I am K2SO, because it looked so much better with him and not me in pajamas, because I saw a lot of me in pajamas.
I hope they release some footage as an extra or something, a DVD of you in the pajamas.
There's some cool stuff. His death and all of that was really cool, because I got to see some of that where I have a fake gun and I'm shooting the gun and they put the laser blast in it.
Oh, that's funny. That's
so
really funny.
I've got a fake gun, but watching, and then you see the stuntmen get pulled and knocked around.
Great. So there's a lot of stuff you're going to do. So you're going to do the King Candy Sings Vaudeville hits.
Yes, I want to do The Book Is So Much Better Than the Picture, which is a great old vaudeville song. I want to do.
I can't remember. How does that go?
The book is so much better than the picture. Oh, how does it go? Something about in the book, they were murdering. In the film, they were just murdering the plot. It's a... Oh, there's some, and the acrobat's daughter, which Daffy Duck used to always sing. She was an acrobat's daughter. She flew through the air on a noose. Then one day,
faithful day, her something gave way. She flew through the air like a goose. Oh, her bridge work gave way. Her bridge work because she was biting on the. She flew through the air like a goose.
She flew through the air like a goose. Like I could, I think this will be, you know, for children, something they ignore. But I mean, for people have a love for vaudeville, which has got to be a huge contention.
For children and their great grandparents can finally come together.
Yeah,
I think, you know, just for fun, just fucking do it. Like they, you know, I think most people consider that now, like it's just a part of our culture. It's just a part of our, you know, mashup fan-made culture. And honestly, they'd be crazy to get mad at you for that, because it re-engages people. Because then people see it, and then it's on the fucking Today Show, and they're like, oh, did you see this thing Alan Tudyk did? And people are talking about Wreck-It Ralph again, and people are talking about other stuff you worked on. I mean, it's like, just these fucking business, you know, it's the business affairs, it's lawyers. Like, we can't let, that's not, you're not allowed to. Why? Why? Competition how? You're getting fucking coverage. This is helping you. Don't be dumb.
It's a weird argument, but they'll make it every time. It is bizarre. It is bizarre. I mean, especially everything I tend to do is sort of in, especially the last few years, is all sci-fi. In the sci-fi world. Powerless has the DC world, Star Wars, Con Man. It's all sci-fi.
It's all parallel.
People fight over that. Like, you can't go do things, even press, other press. I don't want to get into it, but it was, this was some odd.
Like people are going to go, hey everyone, Alan Tudyk was over on that show, but he just did press for this thing, so let's no one watch that thing and go over to this one. Let's go, everybody. Everyone's murmuring as they go to the other thing. Like,
yeah.
It's so silly. Everything's everything now. And the more stuff you do, the more it promotes everything else. It raises the water level. It's nothing is, you know, it's these things aren't. It's not so compartmentalized anymore.
They imagine they're in competition with everybody. Con Man is in competition with anything on ABC. Was my one negative experience where they, because they want to make their own streaming service and they're having to compete with Netflix. And it's like, well, you can have first right of refusal. No, just people who have marching orders, and it's a huge corporation and it's so far from art.
Here's a tip for business people. Make good stuff.
Yeah.
If you make good stuff, no one gives a shit what else is out there.
Yeah.
Just make good stuff and be confident in it. And you make good stuff by empowering your creators. And if you do that, you work with good people.
You might make a dollar, and that seems that's what they want.
Then you don't have to worry about, we can't let them, because then they're going to go, it's like, it just doesn't work that way anymore. Come on.
Come on.
Although I think it's very funny that you are you're doing a powerless panel today on At Midnight.
Yes,
the day they're taping this with Danny Pudi and Ron Funches.
I'm so worried and nervous about it.
I was joking with the writers today about how disarmingly cocky Ron Funches can be. That he's so adorable and wonderful and hilarious.
Mm-hmm.
That didn't you say you're like, oh, you know, I think I might have a shot at winning. Oh, you're not going to win.
Yeah, he said, Alan, you're going to do so well. Because I was like, I don't know, I my mind doesn't work fast enough. I watch it and I pause it and I can't come up with anything. You're like, Alan, I think you're going to do really well because you have ideas and you've got puns and things that you do on set. And so they'll come to you when we do it. And I'm like, so maybe I'll win. Oh, no, that's my house. I don't think you're going to win. And salah. So I want to win. Only because I want a rivalry. I would love to have an ongoing rivalry with him. But then Danny Pudi might be the dark horse who just comes along. But Ron and I have, you know, kind of, I know he has won 19 times.
Danny Pudi, though, is a comedy assassin. Like, he'll, you know, it's going to be good.
Oh my God.
I always feel like Ron Funches is like the sixth Jackson brother that they wouldn't let on stage.
No, Ron. No.
Okay.
Work the curtain.
And then
gonna kill you all.
And he was just bubbling silently all those years. And then finally, that guy's a fucking.
Michael, you know, there's something wrong with your face. You might want to get that fixed. He like puts the things in their head. Later comes back to bite them.
Yeah, I adore him.
Yeah, he's great. I love getting to work with him and Danny. Everybody on the show is fantastic.
I'm so happy for everything that's happening right now. Congratulations.
I should say Vanessa Hudgens.
And Vanessa Hudgens,
yeah,
too.
She's our beacon. We can all, as I said right before we're on a break, and I said we have a week off, and I was like, everybody, try not to die over the break, especially you, Vanessa, because we can all be replaced, but you can't.
The Hudge.
Yeah, she's sweet. I always thought she was like a tough girl because she did a lot of tough girl roles. But she's sweet. She's like, this is fun. Like the type of girl who goes, let's jump. Jumping feels good. What?
Okay, we're all jumping now.
I'm going to sit down over here. Yeah, I'll be over here. Never mind that shit.
I'm thinking about jumping. I'm thinking about it.
Yeah.
So Powerless is on, is it Thursdays?
Yeah, Thursdays, NBC. This will be our second week out. I think it's really fun to make. I think it's really funny. I think they have the right take on it. I've seen a lot of bad pilots, read a lot of bad pilots that tried to make the comedy superhero world come together, and they just went anywhere.
You know what the best pilot was, though?
What?
Kate Duezzo.
Hey, look at that! Better than Wash.
You made the... Oh!
That's a head-to-head.
Fuck!
They both crash.
They both die.
They both crash. They both die.
They both die. What is it that Fillion said you do the thing with the click, click, click?
Yeah, the three things. That was always my thing in Firefly, and then I got to put it in Star Wars.
Oh, that's so great!
I had a role in Star Wars as me, and it got cut.
What was it?
It was a pilot, an Imperial pilot, who was trying to get through the lock and almost gets crushed. He's the last ship that gets through. And in the rewrites, it didn't make any sense to have him anymore. But they were going to credit me as Ray Nearly, which is the character in Con Man. So I was going to be Alan Tudyk plays K2SO, and then whatever Imperial pilot number 16 was going to be Ray Nearly.
Oh, shit.
But it makes sense that he wouldn't. Make it in the final cut.
He got cut out.
I'd love to see the footage, though.
If you do a season 3 of Con Man, you've got to beg for that footage.
John Schwartz, the producers are really generous.
And then that can sort of be the thing that just fucking grates on him is that everyone got to be. He was so close to being in Star Wars.
Yeah.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah.
Well, thank you for weaving wonderful nerdy narratives for everyone. Please continue to do so. I suspect you'll probably just work as long as you feel like working at this point.
As long as I don't die.
Don't die.
Yeah.
Don't die before at midnight. It's only a couple hours. Can you just stay alive for a couple more hours?
I'll do it.
Okay, great.
I'll do it.
Alan Tudyk, thank you so much for being here. And maybe you should sign us out however you want. We say enjoy your burrito at the end of the podcast. However, you can say it as yourself or anyone. It doesn't matter.
Enjoy your burrito. It's like a sandwich, but it's the Mexican kind.
Now leaving Nerdist.com. Enjoy your burrito.
I'm Shimon Yai, and I have a new podcast called The Competition. Every year, 50 high school senior girls compete in a massive scholarship competition.
I wouldn't say I have an ego problem, but I'm extremely competitive.
All of the competitors are used to being the best and the brightest, and they're all vying for a huge cash prize.
This will probably be the most intense thing you've ever gone through in your life.
I remember that feeling because I was one of them. I lost. But now I'm coming back as a judge and also a kind of teen girl anthropologist. Because if you want to understand what it's like to be a young woman in America today, the competition's not a bad place to start.
Hopefully no one will die on stage tonight.
From Pineapple Street Studios and Wondery, this is The Competition. Follow The Competition on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen to The Competition early and ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus.